And all right, everybody, welcome to the latest edition of the 9 years lockdown edition of the podcast. You're listening to the voice of Nick Draper. Today I am joined by George Jones.
Hello.
George, well done. Got your phone off, got your Zoom off mute, that's all good. And also by Kevin Boras.
Good evening.
Who is doing his Unai Emery impression.
Good evening.
Yes.
I'll stop that now.
Yeah.
I liked him. I miss him.
I miss all football, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
Arteta's English is too good. I liked his English. It's great. It's better than my Spanish.
I'm a bit disturbed because Mikel Arteta, I kind of like him, but he is he's the Arsenal manager, so I feel like I shouldn't really. But anyway, that's another conversation for another day. We have a very special guest on the show today, as you'll have seen. So let's not waste any more time. Welcome to the podcast, Terry Gibson.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to join us. We much appreciate the fact you're taking the time to speak to us. Of course, a member of our 1988 FA Cup winning side. But before we get on to that question and questions all about your career with Wimbledon and things past and since then, before we started recording, Kevin was asking you a question about a famous incident under the tutelage of Peter Withe, I believe. Now, Kevin, can you explain to the listeners what this was about?
Me? Well, I mean, Terry's a better place. This is one of those things you hear about at the time in the 1990s, and you're never quite sure if it's true. Now, of course, you can check facts. It's far easier to check. But we were under the impression, Terry. So this, I would love, if this turned out to be true, I'm very pleased. If this turns out to be a myth, I'm going to be very disappointed. So it's not your fault. So we were told that when Peter Withe took over the club in October 1991, he insisted that all players who drove to training came to training in a full suit and tie. Is that correct?
No, it wasn't. There was... Okay. He did ask us to be smarter. So jeans weren't allowed. no earrings. And all players had to be clean shaven unless you were growing a beard. So, you know, footballers are like with a loophole. There it was.
Yeah. Now, the one thing we heard was that one of those instances was that you had to wear a tie. Was that correct?
No, it was. Bear in mind, this was his first speech.
Yeah.
And he was standing there in jeans with a beard, and he had a Pringle jumper on. And I wouldn't be surprised if this was the case, that he'd slept in overnight in his car in the car park. And he was asking us to be no earrings, no beards. No, you had to be clean shaven unless you were growing a beard. He was standing there with a beard, and he had jeans on. So it kind of, as first impressions go from a manager to a new group of players, it probably wasn't the best, if I'm being perfectly honest.
But the mythical story is, Terry, that you have to mind your language here because this is a family show, and we do understand children listen to this show, Nick, don't they? Or George being one, for example.
We say what for the time, so, you know, bad language is acceptable.
But we were told at the time that you had arrived at the ground wearing a tie, a bow tie, in fact, but not around your neck. So, can you confirm that is the case?
I can confirm something along those lines. I didn't drive with a bow tie around where I shouldn't have had. What it was, Peter, I think he tried to come in and rule with a firm grip to start with, because he knew the reputation of the group of players that he was taking over. It was his first job as a manager. He'd been, I think, reserve team manager at Aston Villa. And it was a huge surprise when he got the job as manager of Wimbledon. You know, in the past, there'd been links with other coaches that had been involved at the club. It was that type of, you know, club at that time. And suddenly to have the Aston Villa reserve manager turn up to be manager was a big shock. And he tried to come in and rule, you know, with a firm grip. So that was his first speech. And then after that, he realised that it wasn't going the way he wanted, which unfortunately for him, it never did.
No.
So what he tried to do was try to get some humour into things. So he decided to have a day where we got changed into our training kit and you had to wear a outrageous tie. So the worst tie of the day got an award.
Okay.
Would win a prize. So he arranged for the press to be there to film it and to record it and take pictures, which we knew about. So we had to go out to train in the morning, say 20 past 10, and everybody had these big wide kipper colourful ties on with silly logos on or silly cartoon figures and everything. And I was standing there just in my training kit with no tie. And he singled me out and he said, that's a fine. That's a week's wages for not adhering. Week's wages would have been a bit strong anyway. Hmm. Not adhering to the rules of his competition. So I said, I have got a tie on. And he said, no, you haven't. I said, I have. And I pulled my trousers down and there was a bow tie tied around a certain part of my anatomy. And he laughed. I won the prize. It was photographed. There is a record of it. And it was, I have to say, it's my wife's idea. So her idea was the bow tie. I took it a step further, of course.
Yes. But I think that's actually a better story than I imagined it to be. That was great.
There is a picture. A photographer caught it because the other players didn't know I had it there.
Oh, okay.
So the photograph is of everybody laughing at once when I pulled my tracksuit bottoms down and showed everyone that I did have a tie on. so it's a great picture.
No, that would have just been, meant so little if that had not been true. I'm so pleased it's true. So, George is looking shocked there.
We got a bottle of Christian Dior Eau Sauvage aftershave as the competition winner.
God, it's so 1990s, isn't it?
Didn't really fit in with the Crazy Gang image.
Yes, that would have been perfect.
It should have been Old Spice or a Wild Stallion or something.
And then someone should have drunk it. Anyway. Right. Do you want me to take over then, Nick? Do you want me to be lead as the oldest person here? So I'll go.
Absolutely.
Well, firstly, Terry, thanks for joining us. I'm having a member of the Cup winning squad or team is fantastic. So thank you for taking your time. Where can you tell you, give us your address. Where are you joining us from? We ask everyone. Where are you joining us from as we speak?
I'm at home. So I'm out. I live near Stansted Airport.
Oh, do you? Oh, okay.
Yes. Yeah, in the Essex countryside.
Well, is it a lot quieter at the moment, or are there still a number of planes going overhead?
Yeah, we don't suffer from planes going overhead. We can see them. You can hear them in the distance. At the moment, we're not hearing them in the distance. It's a lot quieter.
Mm-hmm. Right, excellent. So we have a question. Our first question is from Mark Hendricks, one of our own team members. Mark says, Mark is in Switzerland currently. You played briefly in Sweden at the start of your career. Did that assist your overall view of the game by learning a new football style and culture? And did you ever get another chance to move abroad during your playing career?
No, it was when I was 14 years of age, I was scouted by Anderlecht. I was a Tottenham Hotspur supporter. I was already training at Spurs. They were treating me superbly well. but this opportunity came up for me to go and play in a series of tournaments for Anderlecht at 14. So that was an incredible experience. I mean, I was going off and playing in the south of France. We were playing in these tournaments that still don't exist in this country, where we were playing Bayern Munich, Paris Saint-Germain, AC Milan. It was all these massive, giant clubs of Europe. And at that time, mid-70s, Anderlecht were one of the biggest. They were winning the Cup Winners' Cup. Yeah. They had some famous players playing for them. Players like Robbie Rensenbrink, who passed away recently. Duncan McKenzie was there at the time.
Oh, yeah.
So I was going out in school holidays playing for Anderlecht on a regular basis for about a year. And so that was my first sort of involvement with European football. Going on loan to a club in Sweden, it was called GAIS, G-A-I-S of Gothenburg. And it was something that Tottenham did, because I eventually, you know, Tottenham were pleased for me to go to Anderlecht because they knew they had it in the bag that I was going to make the choice eventually to sign schoolboy forms, which was what you did when you were back in the 70s. You couldn't sign a form for a professional club until you were 14, your 14th birthday. So Spurs were quite content for me to travel around to go and play with Anderlecht, get the experience. And they knew, you know, that I was always going to you know, signed for Tottenham Hotspur, because that was the club I supported. They treated me exceptionally well. Nice. So when you got to 17, 18, sort of 19 years of age, they told you that they were going to send you on loan to Scandinavia. And what they did, it was with the young players at Tottenham that weren't living away from home. So we had, you know, boys from the northeast of England, Scotland, Wales. Players like Mark Bowen, who went on to play for Norwich and whatever, and he used to come down. And so they kind of felt that those boys had the experience of growing up quicker, living away from home. So the London boys, the local boys, they used to send us out on loan for the pretty much summer football to toughen you up and play men's football, first team football in Sweden, in Norway. And I therefore went off to play for this second division team in Sweden for about 5 months through the summer. And it was a great experience. I mean, it was tough because, you know, you're young, you're dealing with a different country, people you don't know, you're thrown into the thick of the action. My wages weren't enough to live on because it was such an expensive country.
Yes.
And little did I know that I was also being paid by Tottenham. I didn't realise that such is life. Banking seems so weird now that because I was in Sweden, getting paid in Sweden, I thought that was the only money that was going into my bank account. It wasn't until I came home that I realised I'd, over that 5 months, an extra £1,000 wages have been paid in. 5 months money, that was, as a young pro at Spurs. So that would have really have helped make the experience better. But it was a great experience. I was glad to get back because I was itching to get stuck into challenging for first team football back at Spurs. So it was something that I did. Gary Brooke did the year before me at the same club. Another player called Paul Miller, Maxi Miller, went to Norway. So it was the local London boys that, you know, if they were keen on the idea to go and play out there. So it was a great experience. The team I went to, we got relegated. It was a tough season. We shared the stadium with IFK Gothenburg.
Oh, okay.
We shared training facilities with IFK Gothenburg, and the manager then was Sven. He was the manager when they actually won a European trophy.
Yes, of course.
And we shared the stadium, so I got to go and watch their games. And they had loads of Glenn Hussein of Liverpool was central defender.
Yeah.
The team was ripped apart after they won the Europe. I think it was the Cup Winners' Cup or the UEFA Cup.
Yeah.
The team got ripped apart and they went to Italy and Portugal, big clubs all around Europe. So it was a really good period. As I say, expensive and hard work, but it was a worthwhile experience from my point of view.
Lovely. I'm going to be very nerdy, everyone. I know the name of that stadium would have been Gamla Ullevi.
Ullevi, yes. Yep,
yeah. They've got two now. Gamla means old in Sweden. And they have a new stadium called New Ullevi, Nya Ullevi. Anyway,
yeah. The stadium was too big for us. I mean, we were a second division club.
Yeah, we've heard that before.
2,000 people there. It was nowhere. It was ridiculous. When IFK Gothenburg played there, it was like 30,000. It was a whole different experience. But it was great. I enjoyed that.
Lovely. Great answer. Thanks for that. So our younger fans will possibly know you as, well, would say know you as a co-commentator on La Liga coverage on Sky. So question to Tupac, how did it come about that you ended up working in Spanish commentary? Well, I'm thinking, did it become part of what you were doing because of you were working in Spain for Northern Ireland when Laurie Sanchez was manager? Was it a connection, or am I putting two and two together and making 32?
No, two and two. You're making it exactly right. I've always had a love of European football. As I said, probably because of going to Anderlecht when I was 14 and you know, witnessing all these clubs and players. And I played for England schoolboys, England youth team. We won the European youth tournament, European youth championships. I scored the winner in the final. We knocked out Holland, who had Wood Hullet and Frank Rijkaard in their team. So my European experience has gone all the way through. So I've always watched Italian football, the Spanish football. And because of working with Laurie at Wickham for so many years, it was something I took an interest in and watched, recorded and watched, you know, all the games whenever I could. And then when we left and went to work with Northern Ireland, Northern Ireland was, as strange as it may seem now, and it's not that long ago, we're talking 2004, was a part-time role for the assistant coach, the assistant manager. Wow. So my salary was per game, 10 games a year at £500 a game. So it was sometimes, most of those, you would be away for 10 days for two games.
Yeah.
And you'd be earning £100 a day. When I think back at it now, it's ludicrous. Yeah. And as I say, it's not that long ago. But when we took over Northern Ireland, we didn't have a training pitch. We didn't have portable goals. We didn't have enough footballs. We didn't fly in our own aeroplanes. So we had to get joining, you know, catch, go to the cheapest route possible that the Northern Ireland FA could find. So, you know, to go and play games in Europe, we might have to do a couple of flights instead of one direct flight. It was fun as well. It was tough going, and it was. But again, that was a great experience. But because of my issue with the salary of Northern Ireland, I had to find another job, and it was difficult to match up being away on international duty with any other job in club football. It would have been okay if I'd been managing in the Premier League, maybe the Championship at first team level, because they break up in the international breaks. If I'd have managed, you know, got a youth team job, for instance, or a reserve team job at a club, they still train, they still play when the international breaks are on.
Yeah.
So I had to be creative. And I spoke to a couple of old teammates of mine and asked if they were looking for any scouts abroad. So the idea was to, you know, find a league, preferably Spain, and go and live in Spain and work for them as a scout. So when the international breaks came up, there was no games for me to go and watch, and they were happy for me to go and join up with Northern Ireland. So that's how that came about. Sam Allardyce employed me at Bolton when they were, that's the transfer market they were in. They were bringing in players from all across Europe. And then I took over, then I became scout for Stuart Pearce at Manchester City prior to them having money. Hence, between the two, the debt I racked up in 4 years wasn't as bad as it would have been. So, I mean, neither were well-paid jobs, but they were the two of the you know, my most favourite jobs, to be honest.
Yeah.
I mean, coaching Northern Ireland, we beat England, we beat Spain, and scouting. And the first game I went to watch in Spain was in Seville. It was in October. It was Seville against Atletico Madrid. Young Fernando Torres was playing. Simeone was in midfield. And Sevilla had Jesus Navas, who was 16 at the time, and Sergio Ramos playing down the right side. Ramos was right back. Navas was right wing. Dani Alves was on the bench. He couldn't get a game. They were first choice in both positions ahead of him.
Oh.
And I just sat there and I thought, I had a T-shirt on. And it gave me, you know, I'd had a great experience coaching with Laurie at Wickham for 5-6 seasons, but it ended sourly. I was falling out of love with football, with coaching. So the fact I got this part-time job with Northern Ireland, which was really successful and really enjoyable, and then watching these, you know, new players, new teams, new stadiums, it sort of, you know, rejuvenated my love of the sport, of which I've, if I'm being honest, never really come close to falling out of love with. But it was it was a great new experience and just what I needed. And hence from there, I did that for 4 years. And Sky asked me to become a pundit on the Spanish football. And I was flying back, which seemed ridiculous, for about 6 months, flying back to England to work for Sky, fly back to Spain, until eventually it became too much. And we decided to settle back in the UK.
So this is a question that people ask. When you're commentating on a Spanish football match on Sky, are you actually in Spain? Because I know from experience that the Italian football coverage on Channel 4, when Peter Brackley was commentating, he was in a broom cupboard in Horsefree Road in London. He didn't ever go, and he was also always told, never mention the atmosphere, don't mention the weather, just commentate on the game, don't give people the idea you're there. And of course, when Ray Wilkins was it, he was actually in a different cupboard. They weren't even in the same cupboard. I've seen the cupboards. They were originally actual cupboards with a TV screen, and they were in separate cupboards. Joe Jordan was in several cupboards along in case he kicked anyone. But was that the case with you? So when you're commentating Spanish football, are you actually in Spain at the match?
Well, I did it for 12 years for Sky, and I went to maybe half a dozen Clásicos live. Yeah. They were the ones that Sky, you know, rightly so. I mean, we were showing pretty much every game every weekend. So I was doing games on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, which will almost be impossible to travel around and prepare for each game. So just going into Sky, into Isleworth, to do a Friday match, Saturday, Sunday and Monday at that stage. was far easier than you know, trekking around Spain.
Yeah.
So, but occasionally they would, you know, set you up and fly you out, and you'd be on site in the Camp Nou or the Bernabeu. So that was always a thrill. Funny enough, now I work for La Liga TV, which is based in Barcelona. So I go out to Barcelona to work every 2 or 3 weeks and do Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. So we do previews, post-match. We're in the studio for about 10, 11 hours on Saturday and Sunday doing all right. The games, the build-up, an hour and a half before anything kicks off, an hour and a half at the end of it at midnight, we're still working. And I don't get to go to the games there. So I'm literally 5 minutes from Barcelona Stadium, but still will co-commentate on their games.
From
a broom cupboard. Yep, in a voiceover booth, watching it on television. Right. And with that, they're not as fussy as Sky. They're quite happy for me to be sitting in the studio, previewing the game.
Yeah.
And they will say, and with, you know, thanks, Terry. And now we're going to go over and join our commentary team. Blah, 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 and Terry Gibson, and I'm pictured in Vision, and then as soon as it comes off Vision, I have to run up a couple of floors of stairs and jump in the booth and then pretend I'm in the Nou Camp. So, or I could be in Madrid, anywhere. Yeah. So, but I think people over the years have come to realise that the commentators and co-commentators, by and large, for European games, domestic European games. I think Champions League is different, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think they do go on site, but, you know, it's easier for everybody to provide the comms from, you know, a base in one particular place.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. So Stuart, our colleague Stuart Deakins, not with us today, asks, what's the atmosphere like in an El Clasico game? Which I guess it must be kind of strange because it's entirely one-sided, isn't it?
It is, and I found it really unique. I've commentated on 4 or 5. I think I worked out last time my aggregate score is 16-1 in favour of Barcelona in Clásicos that I've done.
Right.
I've done a 5-1, a 5-0, a 4-0, and a 2-0. So, you know, last season when Luis Suarez got a hat-trick when Messi was injured, that was the first goal I've seen Real Madrid score in the four live Clásicos that I've done. I've seen them win 2-0 and 4-0 at the Bernabeu. So it's kind of the last one when it was when a team is that dominant, and you've got to understand the rivalry. There's hatred for so many reasons between Madrid and Barcelona. And when Barcelona are wiping the floor of them in the manner that they did in the 5-0, I did the 5-0 when Pep was manager in Jose Mourinho's first game for Real Madrid against Barcelona. It's weird to see 90-odd thousand supporters with maybe, at a push, 200 away supporters tucked away high up in the gods.
Yeah.
So there is no rivalry in the stadiums. Likewise at Real Madrid. I've been at Real Madrid when Barcelona thumped them 4-0 there. And all they did was put the supporters wanted to boo, but they were drowned out by the loudness of the noise of the tannoy system. It was genuinely to drown out the noise of, you know, dissent from the home supporters after a 4-0 thrashing. So you couldn't hear yourself think. And of course, as the stadiums, everyone's disappearing, you can see 150, maybe 200 Barcelona supporters tucked up high in the corner. I mean, they're two massive stadiums. And it kind of takes away from what we get in the UK, where, you know, you get a decent amount of away support in the big games. Whereas, you know, I could imagine if it was Liverpool, Man United is, I guess, the biggest rivalry in the Premier League, and no away supporters being in those stadiums. It's that sort of effect. And also, an extra 30,000 people in there, because Barcelona's over 90,000. So it was just weird looking round and seeing everybody in the stadium, and including the whole press box at the Nou Camp, when Barcelona were knocking in goal after goal after goal. And just seeing everybody in one stadium celebrating, it's totally unique. It's a weird setup.
Except when Fleetwood come, because they don't bring any fans. I thought Nick was mouthing the word Fleetwood there.
I was thinking Fleetwood. I was thinking of another team as well, but we won't talk about them.
I was thinking that. Yeah,
I'm trying not to think about that.
Quick one on that, Terry, with the scores you've mentioned about the El Clasico and some of the big score lines they've had in recent seasons. There did seem to be a bit of a shift in in, I don't know, it's a tactical question or not really, but for me growing up, these big games, like say Liverpool, Manchester United would be an example, obviously Real Madrid, Barcelona, you'd get to these big games and teams would set up very defensively, keep things very tight. You wouldn't see a lot of goals in them, very tense, nervous affairs. And then there seems to be a shift in the last decade or so where all of a sudden you're seeing these big scores, and Man City, Man United, for example, you've got big scores, fives and sixes.
Yeah.
Why do you think that change came about when all of a sudden we've got this explosion of goals and these big results that we never had before?
I think it, you can trace it back to a long, long time ago where I think I actually started playing when it was 2 points for a win, 1 point for a draw.
Yeah.
And over the years, it's become this realisation that there has been a change in attitude. Also, likewise, in the European competitions, everybody was happy to go away from home in the first league, for instance, and only lose 1-0.
Yeah.
No one ever really thought about, actually, with the away goals, if we can be a bit more attack-minded and get an away goal, that's much better than losing 1-0, because that used to be, you know, seen as a favourable scoreline. If you went away in Europe and only got beat 1-0 and you could bring them back home, and then you'd think, oh, but if they score a goal away in the second leg, then we've got to get three. So I think there has been a real big change towards, you know, the 3 points coming in. I know it was a long time ago and people, you know, youngsters won't even imagine that there was ever a time and it was only 2 points for a win. Mm-hmm. But it was, and to go away from home and draw every game was seen as a good result. So I think over a period of time, it has materialised that, you know, there is no logical reason why you should struggle away from home either. I mean, I've been asked that question so many times. Pitch might be a little bit different in terms of the size, the length of the grass, but we don't see that in the Premier League now. Supporters, you block them out to a large extent when you're playing, which is another question I was always asked. You're in the zone. You know, unless you're playing particularly bad and getting booed, and thankfully it never happened to me, but you don't hear half of what's going on. And I just think over the years, you know, it's a more attractive way to play, which in turn means that, you know, supporters demand that they don't want to see a Jose Mourinho side. I mean, he's the manager that's possibly over the last few years killed off the Manchester derbies, or the Manchester United against Liverpool derbies. He probably did it when he was at Real Madrid as well with Barcelona. Those games after that first one where they got thrashed 5-0, which I always felt was... It was his first Clásico, and there was a demand from the Real Madrid supporters that he didn't play his normal football. Therefore, he had to play a more attacking game.
Yeah.
And that was only a few months after he took over. And it was almost to me like he was saying to the Real Madrid supporters, if you want to play your way, this is what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And after that, he was allowed, because they didn't want to see Real Madrid get beat 5-0 by Barcelona, he was allowed to go his own way. So Sergio Ramos from then on might have played in midfield. Pepe played in midfield. And there was a turn then of, I showed you what's going to happen if you want to do it your way. This is going to be my way and we'll be more competitive. So there are still managers about. Simeone, for instance, he will, you know, he's not frightened to play his type of football to win games. But I think by and large, the reason for the highest scoring games now, thankfully, is, you know, the managers, their attacking mentality, and I think that the changes in laws of the game have helped over the years as well.
Yeah, no, you're right. I think you're right. So, can we talk about Wimbledon for a bit then?
Please.
So, obviously, you joined us in 1987. There's a story about that element, which I'll come to at the end. Obviously, your first season at the club, we finished eighth and won the FA Cup. Great start. But from that, when John Watson said about the crazy gang beat the culture club, the crazy gang ethic, and was obviously the media took it up, the fans loved it. But I just wonder, when the club adopted the crazy gang as an actual branding thing, and the club was actually, I think it was 93, 94, after you left, the kits were made by the crazy gang. I mean, I don't know who actually made them, but it had crazy gang logo on. It just seemed like the club had taken it and run with it. And it wasn't the point, really. It didn't seem to do it for me. That the crazy gang lost its edge. So did the players, when you were playing in that team from 87 to 92, did you think, as a crazy gang, or was it just like it was a press thing? Because it kind of masked your ability as a group of players, that it was just crazy antics. And you masked a lot of really good players in there who were very skillful.
Yeah, I think I joined in 87, 88. And it was the group of players, that the originators of the crazy gang were Wally Downs, yeah. Stevie Galliers, Paul Fishenden, and there was a whole group of them. They were the crazy gang. I mean, some of the antics they got up to, you know, Dave Besant would have been there, Alan Cork, Sanch at the end of it, but there was a real group of players that were with Harry as manager.
When my
first game was at Derby, and I joined a few days before, and we went up to, and I'd never played against Wimbledon. I'd never played at Plough Lane. I didn't know where the training ground was. That was all hidden from me. So I wouldn't see any of it until I signed. The big reveal came with the port cabins at Plough Lane and the training ground just off the A3. And it was too late for me to change my mind then. Because I was leaving Manchester United in Old Trafford.
It's worth pointing out that you were actually playing for Manchester United at this point.
But that wasn't the reason I was coming to Wimbledon. I came to Wimbledon to play first team football again, and more importantly, to work with Bobby Gould again, who had been my manager at Coventry. So it was the second time he'd bought me. I always felt that when we played Derby, the first game away from home, Derby were a decent team. We went up there, we got booed when we got off the coach outside the stadium. We got booed when we went on the pitch. We got booed for the entire game. We won 1-0. We caught them offside about 60 times in 90 minutes. There was barely any football played. No, nothing from open play. We had free kicks and corners and throw-ins. And we won 1-0 and we got booed off the pitch. We got booed back onto the coach. And I remember saying to Laurie Sanchez, is it always like this? And he said, this is it. This is the Super Dons on tour. So that even the players didn't adopt the crazy gang brand. They called them, they called themselves the Super Dons. They're being ironic. It was sarcastic because we weren't super, but we managed to win games and knew that everyone around the rest of the country hated us. But I mean, it was Colton Fairweather and Laurie Sanchez sitting opposite me on the bus. We're getting dogs abuse as we're driving away from the baseball ground. And they said, no, this, you'll get this everywhere we go. This is a classic Super Don's performance. So I agree with you. It became contrived. And halfway through my period at the club, new players came in and were desperate to maintain the crazy gang brand. But I thought at its peak, it was that first year, maybe the second year as well. But after that, it became contrived. New players came, old players left. We lost the essence of Wally Downs, who had left, and the originals from the crazy gang, which started in the non-league. That they were the crazy gang were the ones that got us to the top division. But I agree with you, it got contrived when it became apparent that people were doing things just because the photographers and journalists were at training. It was almost expected that someone would cut someone's tie or and those things were being done years prior to that. Without anybody witnessing it. It was just for the sheer fun of it. It was a bloody nuisance. The hotels we were nearly thrown out of and stuff like that, because of not smashing up rooms, but making life inconvenient for your teammates, for the manager. Some of the stuff was fun.
We're not going to ask you any specifics. It's fine. Nick is looking.
There was nothing untoward, but you didn't lose your room key on a trip away, because your stuff would be, out on the fourth floor window, bed. All the bedding, so the bed would be stripped. Mattress would be thrown out the window. Remember John Scales' room got done once and they took everything out of the room, all the furniture, and put it in the lift. Not just his clothes, but the television, everything that they could move was put in the lift. And Scalzi suddenly had this horror that we all suffered. You'd look for your room key and you'd go, oh no, while you're eating dinner, the key's gone. Anything could have happened there.
There's a mix of toughness to that, though, isn't there, with players that they know that once you experience that, it brings up the team atmosphere, doesn't it? The bonding of the teammates and everything like that. And also, if you're going to I imagine Derby away, for example, I mean, back in the day, the baseball ground, I imagine was quite an intimidating venue. You needed to be able to cope with that.
Exactly. I mean, those antics were great unless they were done to you. I had one where I'd fractured my ankle. It was a culmination. I'd been twisting my ankle for 10 years and it went, and the club thought I was going to be okay for an FA Cup match in 10 days' time. It was my second season. I did it in training, just went over. Everybody jumped on top of me and started bundling me, thinking it wasn't much. I'd actually fractured it on both sides and it had come apart from my foot, basically. And I went to my own hospital because the club didn't think it was serious enough to get an X-ray. And I had to go back into the club the next day and say, the hospital think I've broken my ankle on both sides. And, you know, the club saying, no, all players' ankles are like that. It's wear and tear. And it, consequently, I had to have it pinned, screwed, and was out for 8 months. And my career was at 26, 27, was threatened. If I'm being honest, I was never the same after that because I had a pin and screws and I've got like 70% mobility in my ankle. And I remember they invited me to go to travel with the squad. I'd just come out of hospital, just had surgery, went up to Everton. I think we got beat in the FA Cup. And I was I was invited to go out and be part of it because I was down in the dumps and thinking that I might not play again. I'd been told that by Steve Allen, the physio and the surgeon. And my room still got done. I was on crutches with my leg in plaster. And they were so nice and they were so kind to me. They helped me down to dinner. And I foolishly softened up enough to think that if my key was by the side of me on the dining table, that they might leave me alone, and they didn't. And I remember hobbling upstairs on crutches in the lift, going in my room, and they'd soaked my bed, soaked my clothes, mattress was thrown out the window, everything. I had no way of getting it back because I was on crutches and still on out of it on painkillers. So there was never any. And then you could never relax with that lot about.
No, because that was horrific. So that leads into my next question, because after you left Wimbledon in 93, you were what, 31? You didn't, obviously, you went on loan to Swindon, I think you played Peterborough and then at Barnet. But was it that injury that kind of curtailed your career then? Because after, you played about, I think, 40 more league games after you left us.
It wasn't just that one. Up until then, I had one operation at Manchester United on my knee. At Wimbledon, by the time I fractured my ankle, I'd already had two hernias. I played in the FA Cup final with a broken foot, and it was a broken metatarsal, but we didn't know, no one knew about metatarsal then. So I had a broken metatarsal and a hernia. I had surgery on the Tuesday after the FA Cup win over Liverpool. Every injury I picked up at Wimbledon was surgery. I'd 8 months out with a fractured ankle, came back, my first training session, someone had a shot, it deflected, smacked me in the arm and fractured my scaphoid. And I'd just been out for 8 months. I'd been training for 10 minutes. So I played the rest of the season with a fractured scaphoid.
You had the wrist bandages for that year, didn't you?
Yeah, but there's a great story about that. I'd done all this rehab to get back from my ankle, first training session, wrist gets broke pretty bad as well. Plaster, going to be out for 6 to 8 weeks. I went to watch a game against Port Vale, and it was a night match in the League Cup. I'd been out for a 6-mile run. It's the only time in my life I'd ever run 6 miles without being told to. And the day of the game, I didn't have to report until later on in the evening. So I went out and did this 6-mile run, came back. My wife said, Bobby Gould's been on the phone. Can you ring him back? I rang him back and he said, I want you to play tonight. I said, I've got my arm in plaster. We'll sort that out when you come in. So I went in and he said to me, he named the team with me in it, with my arm in plaster and a sling. And the players were all looking around thinking, where's that come from? And then we went in the treatment room and cut it off with, I can't remember, scissors, garden shears, anything that was in there. And I've used those for the next 4 or 5 months, played with a broken wrist with bandage, maybe with like a brace on my arm. And then lo and behold, I was told, you'll just go back in plaster through the summer. But the bone had disintegrated and died, and I had to have a bone graft from my hip to my wrist, and I missed the next 4 months of the next season. So every injury I had at Wimbledon was a serious one.
Yeah,
I wasn't missing games because of a pulled calf or a bit of a hamstring. It was fractured ankle, fractured wrist, two hernias. The only time I've ever done a hamstring in my career was at Wimbledon, and it was called an avulsion fracture, where it tore off the bone on the buttocks. So I was running flat out and felt like I'd been shot, you know, sniped. And that took me 4, 5, 6 months. But that was mainly because we couldn't find the problem. You know, it was just treated as a hamstring injury until there was no scans or anything like that, until they realised that I'd see a specialist and the bone had pulled away from the muscle had pulled away from the bone. So every injury I had at Wimbledon was a long one. And part and parcel, I genuinely believe that the procedure in training was exactly like a match day. So although we dished out the physical stuff, we took it back as well. And at 5'4", playing that type of football week in, week out, day in, day out in training, it took its toll. At the time, I wanted to continue my career. I look back now and think, I had, you know, no chance. If I was another club, if I was another scout, I'd look and think the miles on the clock he's had playing for that team for 6 years as a little centre forward, backing into big centre halves.
Yeah.
It was, it battered me, to be honest.
No.
So at 30, I started, my first game for Spurs was 6 days after my 17th birthday. I can't complain with the career. I'd love to have gone until I was mid-30s, but I had 13, 14 years full on and you know, I would have took that, definitely.
Yeah, no, looking back, so it must be sense of satisfaction from what you've done, and then that maybe a disappointment of what you didn't get the chance to do, but I guess, you know.
Like all the one thing I missed was always being the older player, you know, leading, to become a leader and to set an example. And I felt that chance, I still could have done that job at Wimbledon. I really do, but there was stuff going on in the background that, it was always tough going, negotiating a new deal. There was always threats that if you didn't sign, this was going to happen. And I, the first 3 years of my first contract was 3 years. When we started negotiations with the renewal, we was three or four of us were banned, chucked out of the team because we were negotiating rather than accepting it. We weren't going to be allowed to play again until we agreed to sign a new deal. So I did it once. The second time that it was going to come up, I wasn't going to get involved in that again. And as I say, I just think clubs probably looked at me then and thought, well, he's had this injury and that injury. He's played for that mob for 6 years. He's not as quick as he was because I was battered.
Yeah, no, that's fair. The toss of a coin, you know, or turn of a coin. We've got a few more questions for you, but I don't want to keep you too much longer. The one question I've got, I think it's a good question, right? Hopefully it is. So, if you could be remembered for one match, would it be the 88 FA Cup final? Or, when you were at Coventry, you beat Liverpool 4-0 in 83, you scored a hat-trick on match of the day. I think you're not what, about 10 days short of your 21st birthday. Remember seeing that. I certainly saw you play for Tottenham in that Admiral kit with the Admiral stripes or the badge down his sleeves. You had a moustache.
I tried my best.
Yeah,
no,
that was a great
look. I had the curly perm and the moustache. Yes. Who didn't back in the 80s? We all did.
So if you had a choice between those two games, like Coventry 4, Liverpool 0 in 83 or the FA Cup final, what would you rather be remembered for?
Old Cup final.
Yeah?
Yeah, the Wimbledon, the Coventry game. I'm lucky I've got games from each club I played for, which I remembered. And the winning something, the only trophy in my career, that's what you dream of when you're young. That's why you want to be a professional footballer. I played for Spurs in the North London Derby, 5-0 win over Arsenal. Spurs supporters remember that game. They remember my debut because I was so young, so small. I was only, 17 and 6 days old. people, I must admit, everybody was at that game that day. I scored one goal for Manchester United in a year, just over a year, not getting enough football, and that was against Arsenal at the Stretford end, and people still remember that game. It was the first game where Man United Arsenal became a bit tasty, to be honest. David Brocastle got sent off. Norman Whiteside should have got sent off about six times. I made a goal for Gordon Strachan. I scored a goal at Stretford End. And, you know, then it was George Graham and surrounding. It was Fergie's first game against Arsenal. Oh. When he took over at United. Yeah. It was a kick up from start to finish. And Man United supporters and Arsenal supporters still remember that. So I'm grateful, you know, that a little bit of my career has been remembered. But the winning the FA Cup, you know, is the pinnacle.
That's when we picture, if someone's a Wimbledon fan old enough, says Terry Gibson, we think of you in the penalty area in the goal winning, or afterwards with a cup on your head or the lid on your head.
Yeah. Yep. No, it was a weird feeling, I have to be honest, winning a trophy like that. I found the whole day really emotional. I found, you know, from the semi-final on to the final, really worrying. Because I had the broken foot until the last game of the season, away at Man United. I kicked the bottom of Paul McGrath's boot and my foot blew up and I couldn't get shoes on, couldn't get boots on. That became an issue. So I found it stressful and found the day emotional and the Friday before and whatever. But it was such a relief to, you know, to get across the line and win an FA Cup. And not only just win the FA Cup, but beat one of the best teams around at that time.
But you think of a bit of my age, especially, I know Nick was only just born, but as a Wimbledon fan of this length of time, that was 32 years ago, and we still talk about it every day. There's barely a day goes past we don't think about that or mention it, or someone on Facebook mentions they've watched it on video, or watched it on DVD, or they found their ticket. You talk to people over the age of 45, and it's the thing they think of first. As a Wimbledon / AFC Wimbledon fan, it's them. First memory, that and getting into the Football League in 2011. That's the two things that you can't escape from. It's great.
You can't escape it from the FA Cup final every year. That goal will be shown. The penalty save will be shown when they go down the list of famous FA Cup games and victories. That it's there. So if that's the time it sort of sinks home to me that, you know, thankfully I was able to be part of a team, a unique team.
Yeah.
I must ask you, Kevin, I keep talking to people now, and they have this belief that everyone in the country wanted us to win. And no one believes me. No one believes me when I say, no, we were the only underdogs, even if it was against Liverpool. Yeah. I mean, Liverpool, you know, I don't know how you guys feel, but I kind of understand that everyone in the country would rather anyone else but Liverpool win things. But at that time, I remember waking up on the day of the game and seeing headlines in the papers, really derogatory, saying for the sake of football, thrash them, not only just beat them. And it was, people don't get that. They seem to have this, they're under this illusion that everybody in the country wanted plucky little Wimbledon to win the FA Cup.
They did not, at all.
And people, I have difficulty explaining that to people. That we were the underdogs that no one wanted to win, because everyone says, "Oh, I wanted you to win." I say to them, "No, you didn't."
No. I know what it's like to be a player, because when we got double decker buses, rather than coaches, we got double decker buses from Plough Lane to Wembley, and once we got outside SW19, kind of going towards slightly north, the bus was red, but we had yellow and blue balloons and scarves. We were booed all the way to Wembley. So there's no way the country want us to win.
People still think that, don't they?
Which is... No, it's absolute rubbish. Yeah. Yeah, I remember reading us about this. It was the worst thing that ever happened to football.
Yeah, exactly.
The fact that it was a big shock is an insult, because they were, they won the league. We were only eighth. We were only seven places behind them. How's that a shock? In a league match, that's not a shock. It's a slight surprise.
I think it comes down to the history of the clubs, the stadiums, the salaries and the transfer fees paid for their players compared to ours. I was our record signing at £200,000, which, you know, wouldn't have got, you know, I can't imagine what, I think John Barnes was there, obviously their biggest signing at that time, significantly more. I think it was only $1 million though. So it doesn't sound difference now.
Yeah.
But $1 million for a player and 200,000 was a world of difference then. So I think it was all of that made everyone believe, and they were so good as well. I mean, they were fantastic.
Oh, they were. But yeah.
And it was, you know, that's why it appeared to be a shock. I've watched the game once. I'm not fussed if I never see it again, because it's hard work. It's great that we won. I actually watched it, and I never actually got a pass to my feet in the whole time that I was on the pitch. And I purposely looked, I chased everything. I chased Alan Hansen. I chased knock-ons, knockdowns, flick-ons. And my job in that game was to man-to-man mark Alan Hansen. Nothing was mentioned about me being, you know, creative and trying to score goals. Yeah. We had a plan that worked to perfection, and it involved me chasing Alan Hansen or stopping him getting the ball. I was replaced by John Scales, and his job, he's a centre-half. Yeah. He came on and did the same.
In midfield,
midfield. Yeah. I had trouble getting my boots on. I could have played that game in trainers. Because I barely touched the ball. It was just literally, do your job. My job was to man-to-man mark. The only time in my whole career was asked to man-to-man mark a defender and stop him coming out the back with the ball, stop him getting the ball into midfield, therefore stopping the ball to Beardsley and Aldridge and Barnes. And it frustrated the life out of them. So watching it back, I wanted to see how many passes I got. Not one pass.
that's true. You and Corky, I haven't touched the ball. The only player who touched the ball less during that game was probably Grobbelaar, to be honest. Yep. The attack rate off, did we? But hey.
It was just literally, I mean, we never got great service. We got a lot of service. It was never great. It wore teams down. It would be 50 crosses a game. It would be 100 channel balls a game.
Yeah.
One or two of them might be in your favour. The rest of it, it was just repetitive. It was a system of play. But I did, out of interest, look at that, watch that game and think, I wonder how many times actually someone got the ball and looked up and passed it to me. And I actually think I even took the one kick off as well. So I passed it to Fash. So I didn't even get that.
Well, excellent. Thanks for that. So we've got some questions from social media. So social questions. George Jones, our colleague, you've moved in the order of screens. George, you've got a question for Terry about Man City. I was going to ask it, but it's a really good question, so I think you should ask it.
Yeah, so the question that I was going to ask is, obviously you were in Spain at, scouting for Man City, and you mentioned Bolton as well. But when you were out there, what were the attributes you were looking for in a player when you were considering if they'd be able to adapt to come and play in the UK?
Well, they actually signed some. There was Manchester City signed three players that I recommended. And basically, they had to be cheap because they didn't have the money. One of them was a fullback called Javier Garrido, stayed for a couple of years. They bought from Real Sociedad. They paid $1 million for him and sold him for $2 million to Lazio. Martin Petrov, they bought him from Atletico Madrid. He was towards the end of his career at Atletico. He was around about 30 years of age. He came into City and did well for them. And the other one was Pablo Zabaleta. They paid €6 million from Espanyol. It was after Stuart Pearce had left, but the same scouting system was there. And they went and paid when they... It was the first takeover. Do you remember that? From Thailand?
Yes.
That money then bought, you know, one or two players, and Zabaleta was one of those before the current owners came in. And Zabaleta was a fullback from Espanyol for, I think, €5 or €6 million. So primarily then, I wasn't looking at, you know, the top end of the market for Manchester City. It was, you know, players they could pick up reasonably cheap, that were solid, dependable. And Zabaleta clearly proved to, you know, that to be the case. He owes me a drink, Zabaleta.
He's one of those players that fans of other clubs like. I don't know. He's just one of those people that he seems like a decent bloke. I know he's a big fan of Status Quo, which, even so, you don't hold anything against him. So, Nick, sorry, I've got to hog this one.
To start with, following on just because we were talking about scouting in Spain and what have you, Stu was wondering about the La Liga currently and your thoughts on the current situation and how that will affect La Liga and whether they'll be finishing their season, or what your thoughts are on what they're going to do with the La Liga season given the current circumstances, we shall call them.
Yeah, I think there's become a realisation all across Europe. Everything's the same now. I think that they have to finish the season, come what may.
Yeah.
I think that the financial penalties are too big. And I kind of feel like that, that why are we worrying about next season? Finish this one, mm-hmm. have a break, and then we'll start another season. And eventually, you know, in time, the calendar will get back to normality. But I don't see, in Spain, there was initially there was a thought that, like here, the season would be null and void. But I think, thankfully, across Europe now, it doesn't seem to be the case. I think everyone's calmed down. And this season, we haven't got millions of games to go. I think there's 9-10 games to go in most of the leagues in Europe. And I think that can be resolved pretty quickly, a month, 5 weeks, 6 weeks at most. And I think they're quite relaxed about it as well now. So I think they're going the same way as the Premier League.
Mm-hmm. Right, thank you very much. Mark Jones on social media then, getting onto some social media questions quickly. He's got three things he's just asked us to discuss with you. So I'm just going to list these three things and let you talk for a bit, if I may. And they are the Juju Gang.
Yep.
A pre-Newcastle training camp. Mm-hmm. And then finally, a name that came to my mind, I must admit, during the talk about the cup final, Laurie Cunningham.
Yeah, the Juju Gang was, it was a weird set, it was a weird thing. I mean, I've been at the club long, it was my first season, and we kind of had these, one or two of the players, I think Fashion and Vinny were the instigators, they had these little bracelets that ended up in a little gang that they managed to get amongst half of the team. And it culminated in this trip to Marbella, before we played Newcastle, where it actually turned quite nasty between the two gangs. I mean, and it literally was gangs. I mean, there was one gang and the others that weren't bothered about it either way. And it culminated in a training match, which was an absolute disaster. It was literally people trying to break each other's legs in these two ridiculous sets of players. The only one who didn't get involved was Laurie Cunningham. He just stood out on the wing and kept a million miles away from it. Couldn't believe what he was seeing. And it was so, so stupid. But it ended up, sometimes something has to boil up and come to a head.
Yeah.
And it actually did. Everything came to a head on that mass brawl kick up. And from then on, a few days later, we played Newcastle. And from then, I remember travelling back on the train from Newcastle after we'd won. And that was our first sort of moment then where we thought, you know, we could have a go at this year, because we're an arrogant little bunch that thought we could win things and beat anyone we played. And on that train on the way home, I think a lot of it came from the summer before. Some of the players left, the manager left, new manager came in. Some new players came in, and there was a little bit of resentment, if I'm being honest,
right.
Which was documented on the BT, you know, documentary they made. They made life difficult for some. Mm-hmm. I apologise that I didn't realise at the time. I was probably looking out for myself. I didn't realise how difficult, you know, Scalzi and Philo found it. Yeah. And hence, needless to say, they didn't have Juju bands. So it was more of a them and us situation. The new lot were resented, not by all, of course, but it was, you know, there was a nastiness about that first half of the season that came to a head on that trip to Marbella. On the train back from Newcastle, it was the first time I saw all of us together in one place. I came up with the nickname for Clive Goodyear. We were having beers on the way home, and that was the first time I called him Wing Commander Goodyear because of his moustache. He did look so. He's known as Winko, been known from that night ever on. And that was the first trip together where we were all as one, and that was, you know, everything else was in the past.
Beating Newcastle, fifth round.
Beating Newcastle was a massive result for us because we were, you know, up against the 40,000 Geordies, baying for blood. Vinny had grabbed Gazza by the balls the week before. there was all sort of threats going on, and it needed us to be together, and we were in that game, and from then on, pretty much.
Yeah.
I mean, nice. Gary Fletcher has also asked a question about sort of team, should we call it team morale, I guess? Fashanu and Sanchez and their relationship. does that link into anything here as well?
They were on opposite sides, of course, in that mass punch up and brawl and kick up. No, and do you know what? I've no idea to this day what their problem is. I was there my first week, my first home game, and Fash just went across an empty change room. There was only four of us in it. It was 2 hours before kickoff. We were sitting there. I'm still getting to know my new teammates, and Fash just walked across and threw a hot cup of tea over Sanch in his suit and walked out. Sanch didn't do anything. Not a word was said. And from that moment on, I never saw them speak to each other. I was there 6 years. No idea what it's about. Clash of personalities. but it was, I mean, Fash openly said he despised Laurie, and one of his most worst moments when his enemy scored the winning goal in the cup final.
Yes. People have often quoted this about how he reacted to that fact.
Yeah. It's, but they got on with their jobs. They're both hugely important members of the team, valuable members of the team. But it's the only time in my career I've ever come across any instance where I've seen punch-ups. I've been involved in punch-ups. And I've never seen one last for 6 years and lasted longer. Because they were still there when I left the club, and they had the actual fight when I'd already left the club. So no idea what it's about. Clash of personalities, clearly. Two different, completely personalities.
But the only one on that level would be Andrew Cole and Teddy Sheringham. They haven't spoken for 20 years, have they? Over 20 years.
I think I read somewhere that they've finally grown up. and made their peace. But they weren't together that long, were they? Teddy's most of his career was elsewhere. But it's... No, it's bizarre that, you know, I would have found it really difficult not to speak to someone who's in my changing room. So fair play to them. They put a good shift in each.
Well, sometimes for the good of the team, you have to put your personal differences aside. And with that said, we've tried having George on many, many occasions. He's still here, and he now is going to he's now going to introduce a little game for you to have a crack at. George, I'll hand over to
George.
So this is the game that we call Pool Os Who, after one of our current players. And it's basically a guess the player game. You'll be given three rounds of clues. The first round of clues is five players this player has played with. The second round of clues will be two managers he's played under. And then there's a final giveaway clue at the end, if you still haven't got there. And the answers are going to be a former Wimbledon player.
And it's Paul or...
Paul Os Who is the name of the game.
Name of the game. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. George,
so the answer is a former Wimbledon player that Terry has played with?
Yes.
Okay, that's slightly handy to say that.
Okay, so the five players this player has played with are Andy Thorne, Mick Harford, Ian Dowie, Colin Cooper, and Justin Edinburgh.
No, I don't know.
That's a tough one. George, same players again?
Okay, just so the five players, Andy Thorne.
Thorne, yeah.
Mick Harford, Ian Dowie, Colin Cooper, and Justin Edinburgh.
I thought Sanch until Justin Edinburgh.
No, it's not Sanch.
Is there a Luton link, George?
Because Sanch played with four of those, international and club. Just Justin Edinburgh.
There's no Luton link.
No Luton.
So Dowie played for what? Luton, West Ham, Southampton, others.
Yeah, I think it's Southampton maybe.
Southampton link then. But where's the Mick Harford played for everyone except Southampton? Unless he played. Blimey. So someone who's played for Southampton or Wimbledon then? I reckon.
Luton and Wimbledon. No, Luton, Wimbledon. No,
Storms played for what? Wimbledon, Wimbledon,
Palace, twice.
Crystal Palace, Newcastle.
Colin Cooper and Ian Dowie were Northern Ireland. That's why I was leaning towards Sandwich.
Oh, yes. Good
and one. Then Justin Edinburgh that didn't add up.
Oh, yeah.
Because Thorny would apply, Thorny played with Cinch and MacArthur Cinch. No idea.
Go on, Joe. I think you're going
to need to... And I'm glad I'm not alone.
Yeah, no. Managers, George?
Managers.
Dave Bassett and Graham Souness.
Graham Souness.
Okay.
Ah.
So it's
I think I got it. Scousy.
Scousy, yeah.
No, it's not Josh Gales.
No.
Is it... It's got to be a Southampton, because... So who was it? Bassett? So Bassett's Wimbledon, Watford, Nottingham Forest... Sheffield United, largely, isn't it? Will you play with Colin Cooper at Forest?
Yes.
Okay. So somebody played for Wimbledon and Nottingham Forest. Peter Shilton?
No, not Peter Shilton.
It's got to be... He played with Edinburgh at Spurs, right? I'm not being silly. It is a Spurs.
No. Not with Edinburgh at Spurs.
Say again?
Not with Edinburgh at Spurs.
Okay. Edinburgh Spurs.
Oh, God.
Who was Southend, was it?
Yeah, Southend Spurs. And then who did you go to after? Oh. This is going to make great radio for a podcast, isn't it? Thinking of something. it's got this... Oh, blimey. So who's played for Wimbledon and Forest. Southampton?
And Nottingham Forest.
That's a tough one, George. This is a good one. You've done well here.
FN?
Yeah. Who was that, sorry?
FN Akuku?
No.
So it's someone that Terry played with.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't play with FN.
Steve Cotterill?
No.
John Gale. John Gale.
Oh, dear. The thinking man's Carl Leeburn.
No. All right.
I think you need the giveaway clue, George.
Yeah.
Part of the FA Cup winning side.
What?
That's made it even worse. Cool.
Dave Besson.
Yeah.
Oh God.
Yeah.
Wow. We should have done that. But Bess was always a safe.
Yeah,
because he played till he was 62 and he's got like 40 different clubs. Still playing now. Still registered somewhere now, I bet.
Probably is.
And it's funny how we come to know him as Best now. Not Lurch.
Yes.
He ditched that Lurch. He told me when I went to work in Northern Ireland with him. First of all, hello Lurch, how you doing? He went, Gibbo, it's not Lurch anymore, it's Bess. As he was now a member of the staff,
of course, yes.
Calling him Lurch anymore.
Come on, George, that was your best one.
I'm gutted at the Southampton League. It must have been Southampton with Dowie and... Is that right?
Yeah, so he played with Andy Thorne at Newcastle, Mick Harford at Chelsea, Ian Dowie at Southampton, Colin Cooper at Nottingham Forest, and Justin Edinburgh at Portsmouth.
Portsmouth. I forgot about... When was Dave Besson at Portsmouth?
2000.
Of course he was.
Yeah.
Of course he was.
Wow.
Yeah, Southampton and Portsmouth. That's unusual, isn't it?
Yeah.
True. There you go.
Good one. Well done, George. You've excelled yourself. You've made that for all the ones that you've not done.
Yeah.
Okay, Terry, we've got one other game, which is slightly more simpler and straightforward. Very simple question. Kevin's drawn up some either-or questions for you. Just got to give us the first answer that comes into your head, if that's all right?
Of course.
Okay, so, Kevin, do you mind me going through these?
Oh, please do, yes.
Okay. Right, we'll start with Marmite, love or hate?
Do you know what? Neither.
Wow.
Never have it. Yeah, I am literally...
Have you eaten it in the past, though?
Probably not.
Oh, wow. This is something you and Stu have in common. Never eaten Marmite. Wow.
Yeah, no, never. I couldn't tell you what it tastes like.
Okay, well, that's
fair
enough. Yeah. Fair enough. Okay, autumn or spring?
Oh, spring.
Premier League or La Liga?
La Liga.
Did Carol Baskin kill her husband, yes or no?
Oh, yes.
He definitely did. Sean Gibson out of... Peter Kay's car share, or Debbie Gibson, the 80s pop star turned adult film actress?
Debbie Gibson.
Right. Terry McCann or Terry Marsh?
Terry McCann. Was he Brookside?
Minder.
What was he in? Minder.
He was Minder.
Oh, Terry McCann.
Yeah.
Terry okay. McCann. Yeah.
Terry's Chocolate Orange or Terry's All Gold?
All Gold.
VAR, yes or no?
Yes.
Should we sack George, yes or no?
No.
Ron Atkinson or Bobby Gould?
Bobby Gould.
Luton or Watford?
Watford.
Oh, damn. Okay, never mind. And finally, when you make a cup of tea, do you put the bag in the mug first or do you put the milk in the mug first?
Bag in the mug first.
Absolutely, 100%.
Yeah.
Correct answer.
Yeah.
Terry, thank you very much for your time this
afternoon. Thanks, Terry. It's great. Thank you.
Much appreciated.
No, my pleasure. Thanks.
Can I add my anecdote, though? Oh, I'm going to finish my anecdote.
Oh, yes, you do have a story. No,
that's a story.
Oh, yes.
Now, Terry, I'm a law-abiding citizen, but I've committed one crime, really, other than home taping many years ago. I accidentally stole a newspaper from a newsagent while reading that you had joined us from Manchester United. Now, I worked in New Malden at the time, close to our current ground. Is it our current ground? We're not quite sure. Close to King's Meadow. Walked into the newsagent. I was 19 years old, bought a Daily Express, which I apologise to everyone for buying a Daily Express. Yeah, I was 19, didn't know any better. Picked it up, turned the inside page, look at the inside back page, look at the sports page, and it was Gibson joins Dons. And I thought, oh, not Colin Gibson. Sorry, Colin Gibson. And then it said, Manchester United striker Terry Gibson has joined Wimbledon for £225,000. Oh my God! Couldn't phone anyone because there's no mobile phones in the '80s. And I was reading the story, and I walked out the shop, and I completely forgot that I'd paid for it. The owner comes running out and says, "Hey, you haven't paid. You haven't paid." And I said, "Oh my God, I'm so sorry." I said, "It's 30 pence in those days. Handed 30 pence over." And he said, "No. It's not 30 pence." And I said, "No, it's 30 pence. And I've not stolen it on purpose. I've some good news for me." And he anyway, didn't care. I said, "I'll give you 50 pence." He said, "No. It's £5. What is it, £5? He said, it's £5 or I'll call the police.
Amazing.
I've not stolen it. I've just accidentally walked out with it, but I'll give you the money. And he said, no, it's £5. So I thought, I don't want to get called the police on me. So I got my wallet out. I had a £10 note, and he took the £10 note out of my hand and went into the shop and shut the door. I was like, I'm not paying £10 for that. So I called the police. So I went into a phone box, used the 30 pence that he hadn't got off me and phoned the police and told them that this bloke had stolen £10 out of my wallet, and they didn't turn up, and I waited there for 20 minutes for the police to turn up for him stealing my money, and they didn't bother. So I'm not going to ask you for the £9.70, it's fine, but that's so the only time I've ever been involved with the police. The fact that you joined us for Manchester United.
I was actually at Manchester United with Colin Gibson.
Yes.
It's the only place I've ever been where there was two Gibbos. And he was known as Gobbo because he never stopped talking. So I think
it was Gobbo. That's fantastic.
Gobbo and Gibbo. Yeah.
But I was very pleased. In my case, we bought the right Gibson. So
thank you very much. Thank you.
And we have had the right Gibson on the show today. So Terry, once again, thank you very much. Much appreciated. And hopefully, we'll try and get you down to Player Lane when we're back in.
Yes. Thanks, Nick. Thanks, George. Thanks, Kevin, for having me on. It's been a good way to occupy us plenty of time.
Yes. Yes.
We've all got. Thank you very much.
And before we crack on with our usual day-to-day bits and pieces, I just wanted one thing that came up in the Terry Gibson interview that I was going to quickly reference but didn't get an opportunity. The FA Cup final against Liverpool, obviously, the semi-final that year was against Luton. It's just funny sometimes when certain clubs you tend to come up against fairly regularly and they have quite a large role in your history, and Liverpool and Luton are two of those clubs. If you think the first time we got back into the third round of the FA Cup as AFC Wimbledon after our, whatever it was, 15-year absence, it was Liverpool. Of course it had to be Liverpool.
Yes. And
look at Luton, who first team that we played in the conference, the team that we got promoted against in Manchester.
The last team played in the conference too.
And the last time we played, exactly, yes. And their first home game back in the Football League was us, of course. So it's just weird how anyway, right, we have random news stories to discuss. And, oh, look, George, who are you discussing?
Oh, look at that.
Would you leave it?
Yes, so my news story today is about Luton and their chief executive, Gary Sweet, Nick's second favourite person, who has gone on to say that...
Second favourite person? Hold on. Gary Sweet is not my second favourite person. Let's just clear that one up straight away, okay? All right, that's just weird, because that would put him above Alexa Bliss and Bret Hart, which is just not going to happen. So, but anyway, carry on.
But yeah, so he's basically done an article today, done the rounds in the press today, saying that clubs at every level are at risk unless there's a swift and material aid package from the game's governing body, which basically makes it sound like he's going to demand money from the FA to prevent clubs going under. And if a club like Luton is in that position where they've got that mindset, and Luton are one of the most sustainable clubs in the Championship in terms of their losses, we're looking at, you know, how many clubs could we lose this summer before football restarts, whether that's going to be the 2021 season or finishing this season. And again, how many clubs, you know, will we lose? And I think, again, it's another chance for me to wedge in things, saying, thankfully, we're fan-owned, so we'll still be here next season.
It's interesting, George, because Luton won't be in any trouble for exactly the reasons you mentioned. They are sustainably run. They are, of course, fan. They are fan-run, of course. They are fan-run, and that's part of the issue. They might not be. They are privately owned, but they are fan-run. But anyway, Kevin, your random news story today.
My random news story today, yes. This is a kind of a good news one in a strange way. This is a case of life imitating art, where the producers of the TV show Holby City, set in a hospital, have donated two fully working ventilators to the NHS Nightingale Hospital in London. So just the idea that ventilators, which we were, you know, as a hospitals, the NHS are short of ventilators, but there were two on the set of a TV show. So it's great, isn't it, that they've donated them and they will be fully working by tomorrow, supposedly, which is great. So well done to the producer of Hobby City. I'm just not sitting there on their, you know, their studio stuff and their stage props and sets, and they've made use of it. So well done.
That is a very big well done. I'm still, however, mystified by the fact that Casualty and Hobby City continue to be on my TV screen, because it's the most depressing television ever. Who on a Saturday night watches Casualty?
Very depressing. I used to. Yeah. Partly, Amanda Mealing is one of the reasons why, if you're going to ask me, but...
Okay. But is it not a bit depressing for a Saturday night entertainment?
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, falling off ladders, you know, being poisoned, falling into wells.
Yeah. Well. My story is a real-life Romeo and Juliet story that was in the paper today, in the Metro today, in Verona, of all places, where two people have, because of the lockdown, by playing music outside of their flats, which is common in Italy in lockdown, they have met each other and will probably end up spending the rest of their life together, unless their families are at war, I guess, and one of them has to kill one himself, and then the other one tries to kill themselves, and it doesn't quite work. Anyway, yeah, hopefully it doesn't end that way.
Are you not describing my big fat gypsy wedding?
Have you had a big fat gypsy wedding?
No, I haven't had one, no.
You just said my big... Oh, I see. Sorry. Right, I'm with you now.
Plot. Okay. Yeah,
I've never watched it. I must admit, it is my Marmite kind of.
I did watch a Tyson Fury program in which there were some interesting beefs with other travelling families. Not that they travel from his luxury home in Morecambe, but hey,
is that where he lives in Morecambe?
It's in Morecambe.
Mm-hmm. Is there any
huge great house? Enormous great house. Costs about £15.
Well, he's probably got lots of things to do in lockdown. What have you, George, got it to do in lockdown this evening?
Is it related to football, George?
Weirdly enough, yes. What I'm doing now is this week I'm going to rewatch the Amazon Prime documentary All or Nothing, which focuses on Man City. It was a brilliant one first time around, so I'm going to give it a second viewing over this coming week.
Wow. I hate Man City. I didn't want to say that to Terry. I absolutely hate Manchester City. I really, really do not like them. And I used to like them, even though their stadium was in a horrible part of Manchester and it was very, very intimidating. I mean, all those sorts of things. But that Manchester City was infinitely better than this current incarnation.
The one thing I'd say about Man City is, if you're going to have someone come in and spending ridiculous money in an unsustainable manner, Man City have done it better than a lot of other teams by investing in their youth structure and their community schemes.
Yeah, they've done it
just gone in and spent ridiculous money, you know, all on the first team. They're trying to rebuild an entire club around it. And I think they do need some credit for that.
Probably, but it's not going to come from me. Kevin, what's your lockdown?
Well, I've got two things, Nick, obviously. So, continuing with my theme of rediscovering lost albums, I have not played this album for about 10 years, and I played it today. I've already done it. It's the debut album by a band called Cable. Album is called When Animals Attack. If you're interested, go and find it. It's probably on Spotify or on iTunes. Go and find it. So the album is called When Animals Attack by Cable. If you're going to listen to one song, the track called God Gave Me Gravity. Great stuff. It's kind of very repetitive indie guitar stuff. Once Cable discovered a riff they liked, they didn't let go of it. So you might have 4 minutes of the same riff, but it's a fantastic album. Second album is called Sublingual, also worth listening to, but go and find that album. The other thing I'm going to do, I'm going to binge watch, I don't normally do this, the new series Dynamo Beyond Belief, in which not only does he do magic and travel the world, he's also talking about his illness, because he has Crohn's disease and he got food poisoning. It led to the food poisoning on top of Crohn's disease led to arthritis. Extraordinary thing. But there's lots of magic and some great bits of illustration from Damien Hirst as well. I like Dynamo. I'm not a huge fan of magic particularly, and his stuff is illusion, not, you know, but it's good. I've seen the first episode, I watched the other two. So Dynamo Beyond Belief on Sky One.
And can you just repeat the name of the song, the Gravity song? What was that?
God Gave Me Gravity by Cable.
I heard that struggle to get off the ground.
Good one.
Thank you.
Well, and what about you? What
are you doing? I've got two things. One is to simply, I'm just going to say to everyone, go for a walk. Massively important, because getting outside and experiencing nature right now will do wonders for your mental health whilst we're all locked down. Not everyone is locked down, it must be said. There are still people at work that listen to the podcast. They're still listening as they go to their daily jobs and what have you. But the majority of us are not. We're sat at home. We're locked indoors for most of the day. So when you do get a chance to get out, please make sure you do, because walking is absolutely 100% the best thing you can do for your mental health. The second thing I'm going to suggest is, and this is from Steve at @xmr_mac on Twitter, the AFC Wimbledon poker tournament is on Tuesdays and Saturdays at 8 p.m. on using PokerStars. And if you'd like to be involved in that, follow Steve at @xmr_mac or follow at Old Dog Rolf. Now, of course, that's Old Dog Rolf, to find out more details. Ivor was playing it last week. Ivor Heller, of course, commercial director of the club, and he came second last week. And we have a few players registering on top of that as well. So
that's Stuart Rolf.
Stuart Rolf, indeed.
Stuart Rolf.
Old Oak Rolf, as I like to say, because I like to get it purposefully wrong. it's a birthday's game very quickly then.
George, who's doing it?
I'll do it.
Okay.
One each, and then the mirror reader. So, George, Peter Capaldi, the ex-Doctor Who actor.
Ooh, 63. No, 55.
You were closer with 63.
Ah.
61. Kevin.
Yeah.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer actress Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Oh, dear. I've... 42.
So close. She's actually 43.
Wow.
She is actually now known as Sarah Michelle Prinze because she's married to Freddie Prinze Jr.
Oh, from the Scooby-Doo films?
Yes, and writer for The Wrestling at some point. I'm not sure if he still is.
Wow.
And they've been married 18 years, apparently.
Okay, didn't know that.
No, I didn't either. And then finally, Julie Smith from Sutton, Surrey. How old does she turn today?
Julie Smith. I'm going to say she is 55.
George, I'm going to say 60.
She is 52.
Oh.
So many happy returns, Julie.
Well, I went to school with a Julie Smith, who was from Surrey. And I'm 52 in June, so maybe it's the same one. Maybe this is the Julie Smith I went to school with.
It could well be.
What are the chances of that?
It is quite a common name, but...
It is.
Yes. It may well be. Well, which school was that?
That was De Burgh Comprehensive School in Tadworth.
Well, I'll write to the Mirror and find out.
Could you?
I will.
I'm really keen to know this now.
So am I, actually. So I will do that. Sadly, there are no 26-year-olds, so there's clearly no one today that I was at school
with.
Anyway, right, that's it. Tomorrow, Luke O'Neill has been confirmed to join us, so that will be good. A chat with Luke O'Neill. That means George will have to prepare a port or Sue that doesn't include him in the clues, which is
he might not get it. There's no chance he'll get
it. Luke O'Neill, who's the other one you used to put? You like to put in? I forget now. I'll just listen back.
I got the Callum Riley one. It was the only time it actually didn't feature Callum Riley. So that's
yeah, it's Luke O'Neill and Callum Riley because they've played for everyone outside of, well, everyone in League One at least.
Okay, in the Midlands.
Pretty sure.
In the Midlands.
And on that note, on that Midlands accent, we'll say thank you very much for joining us. Kevin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
George, thank you.
Thank you.
And we should be back tomorrow, like we say, with Luke O'Neill. So Alexa, best bag, first milk, last, wash your hands, stay indoors, have a walk for an hour, and we will speak to you again tomorrow.